Welcome to the Memoir Identity Panel, good people. Excited to see all of you. I'm Rayshawna Gray, I'm a member of the program committee, and we're thrilled to have you here with us. As a free event, we rely on donations from festival goers like yourself who are snazzy and fantastic and wonderful. And so if you've enjoyed your time with us, we encourage you to consider donating using the handy envelope in your program guides. Oh no, my phone. If you become a member at the $50 level, you will receive a great anniversary tote bag. It's very cute, great for carrying groceries, and for harboring ill will toward your enemies. For $150, you'll get the tote bag filled with great swag like an umbrella, a book by one of our delightful authors, and some other goodies. Thank you in advance for your support. And now please welcome Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich, who will introduce our session.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming out to the BBF, such a fabulous event for Boston to have every year, and for coming out to this panel, which frankly feels like an urgent and important conversation to have right now as we are thinking increasingly about the way identities play out, not just individually, but in the social, political, and historical spaces. I'm the author of a book called The Fact of a Body, a Murder, and a Memoir. And as I was writing that book, what I found myself constantly thinking about was the way that a story that I had originally envisioned as a story that touched on many elements in my life soon began to include questions of criminal justice, questions of class, questions of access to education, and many questions about social resources. And that made me think a lot about the way that the story of any one life is never really just the story of that life. It is always the story of a moment in time. It is always the story of a social and historical and political and cultural moment. So you can imagine how thrilled I was when I received the box of books from the Boston Book Festival for this panel, and I began reading and realized that each of these books touched on these issues in such new and innovative and urgent and gripping ways. I am so thrilled to hear these three authors in conversation, and I am so thrilled for all of you to buy and read their books, because their books are fantastic. They are gripping, and they feel just so relevant. I'm still thinking so much about each of these books. So what I'm going to do today is we're going to begin by, I'll introduce each of these writers and ask them to read just a little bit from their book so you can get a taste for what their voice sounds like on the page. Because in addition to this urgency that I'm talking to you about, each of these books is also just an exquisite read, just beautifully written. So I'd love for you to hear them read. And then I'll ask them a question about their books. And then when each of them is done sort of doing this, we're going to have a conversation amongst ourselves about how each of these writers approached thinking about these questions as they went to put their lives and the lives of their families down on the page. And then, of course, we are going to turn to you, because our hope is that this panel will essentially become a big discussion. So this is your heads up that you'll be turned to and asked if you have questions. So please begin thinking about questions. All right. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Kendra Tejara Field. Kendra is the author of Growing Up with the Country, Family, Race, a Nation After the Civil War. The book traces her ancestors' migratory lives between the Civil War and the Great Migration. An associate professor of history and the director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University, Field has been awarded numerous fellowships, and excitingly, she is the co-director of the African American Trail Project, which maps over 200 historical sites across Boston. She has exquisitely beautiful maps of these sites across Boston that she would be very happy to gift you after the panel. Kendra, would you start us off by reading to us?
Sure. Thank you so much, and I really appreciate those kind words about the book. I'm going to read a little bit from the preface, just a page or so. In New Jersey, our family was black. While back home in rural Oklahoma, we were Creek Indian, too. As a child in the late 70s and 1980s, I loved nothing more than listening to my grandmother's stories about growing up African American and Creek Indian in 1920s Oklahoma. In the long wake of the Newark riots, watching Odivia Brownfield plant tomatoes in the patch behind her house, I learned about a time when our family had owned hundreds of acres of land alongside our Indian and African descended kin. Grandpa Brown, she called him, had a place they called Brownsville, where they built a school and a church. I learned, too, about the oil speculators who gradually came to see my African-American and Creek great-grandfather. For the occasional lump sum, he worked as a Muskogee translator across Oklahoma, telling them just where to look for oil. Through my grandmother's stories, I learned about Indian and African-American land loss. About once a year, my grandmother would pull out the $25 check she had received from the Sun Oil Corporation, insisting that I look at it too. I remember how she stared at that check, asking questions, already knowing the answers. In grade school, I memorized occasional facts about slavery and the Trail of Tears, but it was through my grandmother that I learned about the intersection of the two, that some Native Americans had held slaves, that some African Americans had participated in Indian land runs, and that the North American frontier was far more complicated than my textbooks let on. During summertime visits to Oklahoma, I began collecting evidence. Uncle Thurman would take us out to Brownsville, driving red dirt roads for hours, following the perfectly rectangular perimeter of the 1,000-acre home place. There was no longer a house, but we found there the steps to the school amid a landscape of tall grass, Indian paintbrushes, and oil wells. One year at a YMCA summer camp in the Catskills, when I stumbled across a collection of Indian creation myths nearly identical to the Br'er Rabbit folktales my father occasionally told me as a child, I ran to a payphone to call him. Was Br'er Rabbit Indian, black, or both? These were the wrong questions, but at the time, back east, there was barely language for what I wanted to know. There was, thankfully, the language of family. When I moved away to college, my family's stories stayed with me, quietly highlighting the incompleteness of other historical narratives. Long before I cared for the discipline of history, then, my grandmother's stories made me whole, pointing to things I sensed, but for which I had no words. The writer Ronnie Hartfield writes, "Our mother's stories have given us the maps by which our tribe locates its journeying, its streams and rivers, its stony places, its sometimes astonishing, more often incredibly affirming, twists and turns." E. Frances White attests that her own grandfather's stories were so wonderful, she said, that I began to believe they could not be true. As she grew older, she stopped worrying about whether they were true or not. She said, "What's important here is that my grandfather told me the stories made sense to me, and most important, the stories made sense of the world for me." As an adult, I also grew less interested in the veracity of the family stories than in the power and the pride that we all drew from them.
Thank you. That was so beautiful. And I love that you chose that section, because what I wanted to also bring to sort of the audience's attention is this quote later on when you say about the complexity of history, mm-hmm. that you're committed to representing this full range of humanity that I have always known as a granddaughter at the table of family history, mm-hmm. but have only rarely known as a professional historian. Mm. And your memoir is written so beautifully from like these two perspectives, and much of it, in fact, is dominated by history, but then the eye comes in and thinks about this emotional connection. And it continually reminded me of this quote by the neuropsychologist Paul Brock, who says that the self is really only an extended story, mm-hmm. a story we tell ourselves over time. Mm-hmm. And it felt to me, reading your book, like the historian in you understands that that self is not only individual, but draws on the past. And I was wondering if you could talk to us about maybe the way your training as a historian mm-hmm. has impacted your understanding of identity.
Thank you for that really, really thoughtful question. I actually did not like history at all as a subject when I was growing up. I hated it in high school. I had a high school teacher who pretty much taught the U.S. presidents, and I remember thinking, this is not me, this is not us, I don't know what this is, but I don't like it. And I was an English major and all the rest of it. But before I even had language, I had my grandmother's voice and her stories. I was so fortunate to grow up close to her. And so I had this other version of making meaning of the past that was really important and, you know, foundational to me and to my own kind of development and myself. And I think that I went to Williams College here in Massachusetts, and I refused to take a history class. I had a friend that said, just take one, and my roommate, and I took one, and I was so lucky because it was Professor Craig Wilder's first teaching job. He's the wonderful author of Ebony and Ivy, and a professor at MIT here in town, and it was his first job, and he gave me permission, essentially, to look at the connections between what I, you know, found meaningful and what I was seeing in books, and of course, he was assigning amazing works of history. So I can always have had, mentors and teachers in the professional world, to your question, that have been kind of on the cutting edge of experimenting with what counts as evidence. You know, mm-hmm. a question that is, preoccupies most of my work as a historian. You know, what gets to count and why? Why didn't folklore count until very, very recently, when we had so few other forms of evidence about the history of people of African descent in the Americas, right? I mean, use everything we can get our hands on. Not to say we take anything at face value, because who does, right? Take anything at face value, but we read everything and use everything we have access to. So.
Fantastic, thank you. All right, our next author is Catherine Guthrie. Catherine is the author of the queer feminist cancer memoir, Flat, Reclaiming My Body from Breast Cancer. I'm quite sure Catherine's sick of me telling this story, but I will say I've known about this book for quite some time. I used to teach a program called the Memoir Incubator at Grub Street, and one year I opened the application system just to check it, and Catherine's application had landed in. It was 70-something pages at that point, and I read it on my cell phone without moving, because I had started reading it just thinking it was like the application sample, and I'll just make sure the system's working. But then I couldn't move. I had to finish the whole thing. Now it's a book. So a fantastic book. Catherine is a women's health journalist, and her essays and journalism have appeared in dozens of national magazines, everything from O, the Oprah magazine, to recently Cosmopolitan, to Time magazine, and Good Housekeeping. Catherine, would you read to us?
I would love to. Thank you for the introduction. I appreciate it. And thanks for being here, everyone, and thanks for inviting me to be a part of the panel. So I'm going to read a little section from my memoir, Flat, and I think all you need to know at this point is that it's been 5 weeks since I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I'm thinking about reconstruction. I'm also thinking about going flat, but I didn't know anyone my age who had had cancer and chosen a double mastectomy without reconstruction. So I invited my friend Tad over to the house. And why will be explanatory, or will be clear in a moment. So my friend Tad came by the house, and we spirited ourselves upstairs and into the bedroom. Tad was transgender and raised female. He'd undergone top surgery years before. What had prompted each of us to consider surgery was very different. But he was the only person my age who'd had a double mastectomy without reconstructed breasts. His fingers fumbled with the buttons on his navy blue shirt. I kept one eye on the bedroom door. My stomach twitched as if we were two scheming teenagers. A few seconds later, the last button slipped out, and he opened his shirt to reveal a white cotton undershirt. He removed the button down, hanging it by the collar on the doorknob. He stopped to clear his throat. Ugh, was this too much to ask? I thought to myself, would this damage our friendship? He and I were alike in that we were both shy and sensitive, but there was so much I'd never known about the years of pain and anguish he'd gone through to become who he was today. What I did know was that he was kind and generous, if not a bit cranky like me. He was also a studious consumer of healthcare. Like most queer-identified trans men, he had to be careful, seeking out surgeons and providers who were able to open their minds beyond the binary. For my part, I had just spent days scrolling through pictures of cookie-cutter implants and breast mounds crafted from flaps of tissue. I wanted to know what a reconstructed flat chest looked like when a surgeon applied the same skill and care that so many plastic surgeons were applying to reconstructed breasts. Mm. Sitting on the bed, my hands shoved under my thighs, I stared at Tad's thick-soled work boots, then lifted my gaze up past his slim waist just as his fingers took hold of the hem of his white undershirt and lifted it. An appreciative "Whoa," was all I could muster. The skin of his chest was flat and smooth. He had small round nipples, each one centered on top of a plateau of pec muscle. There were no glaring scars, no bumpy outcroppings of ribs, no dog ears caused by extra flaps of skin some surgeons left behind at the incision's outer edges. He showed me where his surgeon had hidden the scars in the groove beneath his pec muscle. It blew my mind. Every mastectomy photo I saw had a thick scar that ran right across the middle of the breast, as if the surgeon had sliced it open like a baked potato. All of the flap surgeries left massive scars. There was no attempt to hide anything. But Tad's scars were barely visible, hidden in the shallow dip between his chest and upper abdominal muscles, two thin pencil lines. The part of me that is versed in sexuality and gender 101 knows there is no comparison between a transgender man's post-op chest and a cisgendered woman's double mastectomy after a breast cancer diagnosis. But the part of me that was freaking the fuck out about what my own chest was going to look like at the end of this ordeal was the part that was in the bedroom with Tad that afternoon, the part that had mustered the confidence to ask such a personal favor. And the latitude I had to explore these questions was shaped and enabled by queerness. The beauty of queer culture was the diversity and plurality of its citizens and their intimacies. Mm. Being queer meant pushing against cultural assumptions of who you are supposed to love and what bodies are meant to look like. It was a provocation to do things differently. When my doctors told me I should reconstruct my breasts, they were coming from a place I'd abandoned long ago. A place where it was important for women to have breasts because breasts were desirable to men. Mm. Because I did not want to be desired by men, I had the freedom to explore what I wanted for myself.
Wow. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Catherine. So I was struck in that excerpt that you just read by the multiplicity of identities that are going on, where you're thinking about yourself in relationship to the cancer, you're thinking about yourself as a queer woman, but you were also a journalist when you were diagnosed, and are a journalist now, yes. But you were a journalist reporting on breast cancer when you were diagnosed. And of that journalism, you write elsewhere in the book that you experienced this pressure to create simplified narratives. Mm-hmm. And you write, "Why did I keep at it? Because someday I'd be better positioned to create smart, interesting stories that would make a difference in women's lives. Maybe then I'd influence someone's health decisions for the better." And I'm wondering if you could speak to us a little bit about that duality, that position of being in the subject position, but also in the observer journalist position, mm-hmm. and how you navigated that duality in writing this book.
Mm-hmm. Great question. It was not easy. I think in some ways to write the book, I had to put aside my identity as a journalist and embrace my new identity as a memoirist, which I learned very much working with Alex at Grub Street. That was amazing. But the journalist in me had to take a backseat to the memoirist. I needed to write the story that happened to me, not try and report on the bigger story. And the beauty of that kind of holding both identities, the memoirist and the journalist, is that now that the book is finished, I can move between those two identities. I can be here as a memoirist, and I can write more complicated pieces as a journalist and use the book as a platform to get into bigger magazines, to get into national news, you know, radio, television, that sort of thing. And it's just wonderful to kind of be able to ping pong those two things back and forth.
Thanks, Catherine. Thanks. Okay, and our last author on this panel is Sisonke Siemeng, is the author of Always Another Country, a memoir of exile and home. She's a South African writer whose work is focused on race, gender, and democracy. She has written for a range of international publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, Newsweek, and Al Jazeera. Would you read to us, please?
Sure. Thank you for that introduction. And thank you. It's so great to see a full house. America gives me anonymity, and also it gives me love, in that order. The two are intertwined forever in my heart, and both belong in that place inside me that belongs to America. So this is from the chapter called Black Girl in America, and it describes when I arrive in America when I'm 18 years old. Anonymity comes first, in the terrain of the unknown, in this landscape where I am nobody special, in the crevices and dark shadows of places where I have no birthright, I find love. Until now, I have always been at the center of the universe. I was born into an Africa that was waiting for me and into a movement that needed children as emblems of the future. We were totems, all of us, grand experiments who were testament not just to our parents' love, but to the ability of the struggle for liberation in South Africa to regenerate, to sustain itself. It wasn't just us, the liberation kids. All across the continent, we were Africa's promise, middle-class children who were birthed with the sole purpose of walking away from the past with determination and absolute confidence. The post-colonial children of the elite, those whose parents' hearts were filled with dreams, we carried the vision of a decolonized future in our smiles. In America, however, I am given a new meaning. I am not the center of any universe. I am just a black girl. In America, I learned quickly that to be black is to be both unknown and unknowable. As an outsider, I see almost immediately that this society deliberately misrecognizes black people, and the effect of this is to diminish them individually and as a group. At first, I marvel at the stories of mistaken identity. My friends in college were the best and brightest in their schools. That's why they got plucked, pulled up into private four-year colleges. They are shining stars, known and seen by everyone in their communities. But the minute they step beyond their shattered, drooping blocks into the cities that gleam and glitter grandly, they become invisible.
Thank you. That discussion of navigating identity and navigating the visibility of identity is one that comes up again and again in the book. And there's a quote earlier in the book that I wanted to briefly read to the audience that says, "When you are a child who grows up in exile as I did, when you are a refugee or a migrant or someone whose path is not straightforward, you quickly learn that belonging is conjunctive. You will only survive if you master the words if and but, either and both." I loved that idea of identity as being conjunctive and belonging as being conjunctive. And I know that you've also done a lot of work as a political analyst. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the way that your work as a political analyst and your awareness of those lines of identity and the end and the but and the both have influenced the way you think about identity.
Yeah. So in part, I think my work as a political analyst hasn't been very successful because I insist on complication. So they tend not to bring me back to TV. I'm like, well, it's complicated. Which is why I like writing, actually, which is why my preferred sort of mode of communication is writing, because you can explain yourself and you can delete and you can think and you can stand up and walk away and then think again, and it's not, you know, Twitter. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, television. I think there's something about the distance between proclaiming something, thinking about something, and then proclaiming it that's important. And that sort of feeds into your question, this idea that it can be either or both, that sometimes the answer isn't only one thing, feels like it's fundamentally important, you know, both to political analysis, but also to like how we live our lives. It feels important to, you know, how we do politics in the real world. It feels like it's kind of more important than ever, you know, in this political environment. You know, I live in Australia at the moment. I'm in the US often. And it feels like the being forced into making one choice is what makes discussions very polarizing right now. And mm-hmm. I insist on not being one thing. I think that's ridiculous. We're full of lots of stories, and so we don't choose one to be one thing. That would be kind of like death.
So there's this beautiful theme of complexity that has just come up in all three responses, I think. And my first sort of group question for us, which isn't the first group question on the list, isn't even on the list, but let's just throw away the list because this has come up. And I'm curious, as a writer, when you're taking a reader through a book, you have to sort of give them something to follow, and you have to kind of create your own, construct your own identity on the page. And often it ends up being a little bit simplified. The writer Vivian Gornick, in the book, The Situation and the Story, says that after all, in life, you know, she's many things. We are all many things. But on the page, very often, who you are is like this construct reduced down to serve the subject of the book. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how you all navigated your awareness of the complexities with the very simple need to give the reader something that, who doesn't know you, to give the reader something you can follow along.
Mm-hmm. I didn't. I mean, yeah, that's so for me it was very much about I think there's a couple of ways to do that as a writer and as a memoirist in particular. So the one way is as you describe it, to sort of think about who you are in a kind of essentialized way for the purposes of making people understand you. The other way to do it is to kind of lean into the complexity of who you are, but to choose a theme that makes sense. So I was, you know, really taken with your description of maps, because once I decided that my book was going to be about belonging, that, you know, because I grew up in exile, I was born in exile, and then we moved every 3 to 5 years. We're constantly moving, and so no place was home. So it made sense that the theme be belonging. Like, I could have chosen many themes, or any number of themes for the book, but I chose the one. So that decided how I would bring my complex self to one particular topic. So that's how I made the decision, but, you know, I don't know if it works, but...
It works.
Yeah.
It works beautifully.
In mine, because my book is primarily, it's an illness memoir around breast cancer, clearly. And so my identity, my queer identity took a back seat to my identity as a cancer patient in this book. And there was so much complexity that I wanted to unpack around breast cancer and the decisions women are asked to make around their surgeries that I did refine and simplify the queer angle or identity in the book. For instance, you know, this morning my partner was pointing out that I identify myself as queer throughout the book, but she's like, you know, when we first met in your 20s, you were identifying as a lesbian and not queer. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, but that's just so hard to explain why I shifted and that transition from calling oneself, you know, a lesbian or a dyke or a slacker femme is what I went by for a while. There's an evolution, right, of identity. And in memoirs, if it covers, you know, some span of years, your identity is evolving. You can write about that. But because my primary focus was on cancer, I wanted to simplify and refine the queerness so that it didn't take center stage.
I suppose it's a little different in my case because the book takes place largely in the late 19th and early 20th century. and I'm in it, as you pointed out, in the beginning and the end, and kind of the beginning and the ends of chapters in ways, but I'm absent for a lot of the middle section. That said, I think it does, precisely these questions about kind of leaning into the complexity were, as you put it, is just what motivated how I entered the past to the extent possible. I made a, you know, rather deliberate choice. I talk about kind of choosing a place and choosing places where there are not kind of easy heroes or villains, right? That kind of usually sends me in the other direction, and I'm much more fascinated by the complexities. In this case, I was looking at, you know, my grandmother's grandparents' generation, and they're in, you know, Indian territory. Most of them identified as were identified by the government as black or as mulatto at the time, and are in a place where there are not that many white people, right? But there are African Americans who are settling on land that was supposed to be Creek or Cherokee land for perpetuity. Post Trail of Tears, there are Native Americans who they live near and sometimes with who were their parents' former slave owners, right? And I think that's a fascinating place to look at and think about power. Because actually the US, you know, nation state and, you know, white racial nationalism is functioning all throughout it, even though there's not actually people that you can place that on, right? And so that's where my kind of curiosity about complexity, I think, enters in this case. That's partial answer.
That's fantastic. And I love that you've brought up power. And all these books, all of your books sort of navigate this way in which identity is both personal, but also identity is culturally constituted and is constituted by history and is also the result of forces that are enacted upon us. And I'm wondering how, as writers, you found yourselves approaching those lines on the page, approaching how to sort of show this complexity again, we're back at complexity, but how to show this interplay between the personal and the culturally constituted.
I mean, I think that came up, you know, very much in the passage I just read, looking at, you know, the pressure I faced to reconstruct as a woman, the assumption was, of course, you want more breasts. Of course, we're going to do this, even if it means severing muscles from your back and wrapping them around your front to make new breasts. And that was the societal construct of what all my medical providers assumed was my top priority. And like I read in my passage, I was not working within that framework at all. And so that clash between, you know, the pluralities, the diversities of bodies in the queer community, how I had come to accept and love my own body, the clash between that and then having these medical providers who are like, we're here to save your life, and part of saving your life is rebuilding some breasts, because men love breasts. And I was like, oh my God, you know, that it's, when it's packaged as part of a life-saving treatment, heteronormative femininity is very alarming if that's not where you're coming from. So it was, there was quite a friction, as you can imagine, and that's what gave rise to the book. Mm-hmm.
Can you ask the question one more time?
Yeah, what I'm curious about, and it comes up so much in yours, is how, as a writer, right, you're navigating where to bring in the strictly personal and where to focus on cultural and historical forces.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, I can speak to that. So obviously, because I'm writing about, you know, some, you know, 4 or 5 generations in the past, I'm writing about people who weren't themselves writing in most cases, and I'm committed to being able to somehow write life stories of, you know, in this case, my ancestors and others who didn't necessarily have access to the tools of either recording in the first place or of holding on to those things because of a series of displacement. So that meant that I might start off saying this chapter is going to be about this particular person. In many cases, I had bits and pieces of stories about men, right? And I had almost nothing about their wives and daughters in this case. And so I would then go out and say who was living next door, who was living down the street, who was living in the next county over, who was it born in the same year or the same 5-year period, who perhaps left more things behind, right? And so I end up kind of reconstructing whole communities in order to approximate what someone's experience might have been like. So although there are, it is a family history, and you know, focus on my father's side of the family, there's many more people whose experiences I'm drawing on in order to try to paint a picture. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of you know, experimental, you know, methodologies that historians traditionally haven't used because they haven't been taking on these kinds of places and people.
I think for me, because my my story begins with Nelson Mandela being sentenced to Robben Island. So that triggers my father leaving South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so without that, we have no story. So it's so intrinsic. And then we return to South Africa when Nelson Mandela is released from jail, right? And so growing up, you know, every time we would move, you know, as a kid, you're like, you know, we're moving again, you know, and you're, it's kind of hard to, you know, beat your parents, to trumpet when they're like, well, when Nelson Mandela is free, you know, like, okay, well, all right, you got me on that one. I'm not going to complain. So the politics, you know, is very much part of the personal, you know, really it was given, it was handed to me on a kind of platter. Mm-hmm. But I am, you know, I am also, you know, I think probably for all of us, you know, part of choosing this memoir was certainly for me thinking about what are the stories that exist in the world that people are familiar with, that people will have encountered, and then and choosing mm-hmm. to tell my story, not because I think mine is a particularly interesting life, but because it's a life seldom encountered in on the page, mm-hmm. and that means something, I think, very political. Mm-hmm. And then when you make that decision, and it, you know, in South Africa, like there's these big men whose stories you know about South Africa. So Nelson Mandela is the one, you know, wonderful as he was, his shadow kind of dominates our entire country. Or Cecil John Rhodes, you know, Rhodes mm-hmm. Scholars and all that stuff, you know, pretty horrible man, but another big man character. So the stories of women and girls, and particularly like those of us who were ordinary, who weren't like big political heroes, who just happened to be collateral damage, you know, against this backdrop of a much larger story, that has always been interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing that I encountered. And then probably lastly, like reading other memoirs and thinking about what's happening in the cultural conversation, you know, America looms so large for us. It's such an important, it has been, it continues to be a very important country culturally, even though politically it's, questions, big question marks. And you know, you read people like Ta-Nehisi Coates, and you know, part of what he does when he's writing isn't just to tell a story that you may not have thought about being complex and blah blah, but he does what I heard in, you know, in both of your readings today, which is like he writes about the people that he knows and loves with so much care. You know, there's a real reflection and thoughtfulness and care in the way that he describes like black men who are typically like gunned down, right? It's like so much lack of care for those bodies, and yet he writes about them not as bodies but as lives in such like beautiful, like the attention to the beauty of the language, I think is a political act. And so I worked very hard on my sentences, not just because I want to be a good writer, but because I think there's a politics in writing beautifully about lives that are seldom thought about by, you know, mass mainstream, whoever mainstream people are. Yeah.
How did writing these books change your understanding of your own identity? I didn't tell them I was going to ask them.
These are hard questions.
But I'm curious, and so I'm going to sprinkle in. Because you're all describing thinking deeply about this complexity, and I imagine from all of you that it, being steeped in this complexity is something that you have thought about a great deal over time. And yet I imagine it's a little bit different to put it down on the page, to really go through that process, that journey. And I'm wondering, you know, these books exist now. I'm holding all three of them. They're wonderful. They're beautiful. You should buy them in the back. How did that change you, if it did?
Anybody else want to start? I can fumble my way through while you guys think of
thank
something.
You.
I'll do that for you if it would help. Well, I mean, for me, where do I begin? When I was a healthcare or a women's health journalist for many years before I was diagnosed with breast cancer, I wrote about breast cancer, but in the back of my mind, I was always like, oh, you know, breast cancer, it's got all that pink ribbon business. It's just so feminized. It's infantilized. It's got issues. And I'm just I can't deal. I can't tackle that. I want to write about things that are just more interesting to me, things that are less feminine, things that are less stereotyped. And then it happened, not once but twice. And so here I am, almost 9 years after my initial diagnosis, and I have a breast cancer memoir, and I talk about breast cancer nonstop. And it has become a big part of my identity, and part of my identity with breast cancer has been being that person who asks the difficult questions, being that person who provokes women to think about what they want for their bodies after cancer, not what their doctors tell them they should want, not what their partners, husbands, everybody else thinks they might want. So now that's my identity in a way, and I've just embraced it, and it's been amazing.
I think for me, it wasn't the writing of the book, but it was like the publishing of the book where I was like, oh, I've put this stuff out there. Now I have to think about what that means. So I think for me, in my sort of real life, when I'm not writing, I help people tell stories. So I do lots of oral storytelling, and I always tell my storytellers that, you know, a story is not a story until it's over. So, you know, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and sometimes you're trying to tell the story, but it's not finished. So you can't really tell. That's why you keep getting stuck. And so for all the little stories that I put into the book, I chose them because they were finished, which meant that I wasn't changed by it so much as I was changed and therefore I could write. You know what I mean? That stuff was already done, which made publishing it easier in some ways, because I always tell my storytellers, that if you care about people's response to your story, then you're probably not ready to have it out there. You know, if you feel like you'll be judged and that judgment will hurt you, then let's choose another story. And so that I applied that in the book. So there isn't stuff in there that I'm not okay with. So it's vulnerable, but it's not exposed. I don't feel exposed. And so that, I think, has been good. I mean, I would probably make a few decisions differently, having had it published and then having people talk about it, especially at home in South Africa. It's been interesting because it's also made me realize that there is a lot to be said for keeping some things to yourself, even when they don't expose you. Mm-hmm. So there is privacy is important. Mm. So there are some things which aren't too personal, but that are still private, that I might rethink if I were to do it again. Yeah.
I often say that, you know, had I entered into this project when I first, you know, took that history class I mentioned when I was 19, it would have been, you know, a mistake, right? Because I would have been kind of wearing my identity on my sleeve. And it would have all been about actually, you know, me in a way that I hope that, you know, with the luxury of the time that passed in between, and also by that point I was becoming a historian, you know, I approached it differently, I think, with a lot of just genuine curiosity about the world, right? And then also, you know, consciousness about, you know, my place within that, and also a sense of kind of stepping into history, you know, which I think of as, you know, adulthood, basically. and then in my case, also parenthood. You know, I have a 7-year-old son, and you know, when I started this book, as I say in the preface, my father was very sick. He'd been sick my whole life. He'd been born in Oklahoma, and he loved our, you know, family history and the history of the places that I write about in the book. And I was taken care of. I'd gone into public policy, don't ask why. And I had done my master's in public policy, and I was trying to figure out what I was doing with my life. And then I just quit, and I was taking care of him the last 2 years of his life. And shortly before he passed away, he said, "So when are you going to write your book?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "What book?" You know, I didn't think that I had a book to write. But then after he passed away, his mother and me, my grandmother and I, ended up, you know, spending 10 years, she outlived him by 10 years, really doing the research for this together, going back and forth to Oklahoma, interviewing her uncles who had been born in 1903 and 1905 and were the part of the generation that I'm writing about in the book. And it just was such a gift, you know, and so I think that putting it down on paper really kind of affirmed for me these things that I'm now interested in, like, oh gee, all, you know, why do people repeat certain stories, and why do other stories never become stories? You know, why are certain things unspeakable? Of course, we all know the answers for particular cases, but just how universal these things are. And I teach a course on family histories to students here at Tufts, and teach them how to kind of research and write family history with the kind of rigor of a historian. Mm-hmm. But a lot of, I mean, we're not doing family as biology, but family as kinship and attachment and who parents whom. And I think a big part of the revelation for me finishing this book is just how universal so much of this stuff is, and how cathartic it can be to kind of sit down and explore it.
Thank you. All right, so it is now time for me to stop asking questions and you all to start. So if you've got a question, which I hope you do, since you've had some time to think about it, we would love it if you would come up to the microphone in front to ask it. Fabulous.
Why
you.
Me?
You're starting us off.
Yes. This question is for Sisan Kim Samang. I was really in, I came to like see you for the first festival of Goer, so I'm happy to be here. I was interested. It's kind of a familiar narrative reading other writers' experiences of coming from the continent to the U.S. I wanted to know what was your experience then being a South African in Kenya and then Australia, and like kind of how was your identity plotted around the world, and then maybe your thoughts on, you know, how like that could tell us something about the possibilities for like a Pan-Africanism or like a pan-globalist like pro-black kind of movement.
Seldom a question I get from a white guy. That's great. So one of the things that I've realized, you know, the older you get, the more the things that felt like deficits when you were growing up are actually strengths. And so part of the rootlessness has resulted in a feeling of familiarity in many places. So it's kind of easy for me to get somewhere and like figure it out. But I've also had enough experiences in societies where I'm both demographically a majority and societies where I'm demographically a minority to kind of think about the contours of racism and how they apply differently in those different contexts. So certainly as a South African, you know, exile kid growing up in Kenya, the first time around was just interesting because Kenya had no politics. It was a post-independence country that wasn't committed to fighting apartheid, which was kind of weird. It's like, what are you doing? You're supposed to believe in us. Like, people in Britain care about us. And like people, you know, the Kenyan government doesn't care if South Africa is free or not. Like, you know, so that was interesting to just encounter a kind of African society that didn't care about other black people. And then, of course, my encounter with, you know, being in Kenya when I was slightly older was that I was now a middle class, you know, in my lifetime have gone from being like a refugee kid with very little resources in our family to being a middle class African who comes with all the, you know, where I'll assume that many of the people sitting in this room are middle class, were participating in a profoundly middle class behavior. and that comes with a certain arrogance, right? Middle class people think that their views are very important, we've been educated, you know, like we think we're great. And so, you know, being an African middle class person who then arrives in an Australia
or in an America, you know, this is part of why I talk about not being recognized or being invisible. Like, I'm used to being hyper-visible. Like, I'm a middle-class person. Like, you're supposed to see me. You're supposed to hear my voice. Like, what I say matters. And then, like, because of this, you don't see me. It's disorienting. So my assumption about myself is that I'm very special. And then I go to a place where there are very few black people and where the invisible or hyper-visible in a weird way, where I'm used to being hyper-visible because of my class position. Mm-hmm. So I bring that all, you know, I bring that thing, that arrogance to certain places. I'm refusing constantly to be what you think I am. But also, I think, hopefully, you know, as you get older, a humility that your middle-classness does not entitle you to have the loudest voice. In fact, you need to, right? And then to understand what the contours are for black people, people of color who live in those societies, who don't come with not just that arrogance, but with the confidence that comes with having grown up being a black person amongst black people, so you don't have to question mm-hmm. what it means to be, are black people beautiful? Are black people intelligent? Of course we are, and some mm-hmm. of us are dumb. Of course, some can we dance? Well, some black people can't dance, right? So that complexity, that's what you bring, you know? So in terms of the second part of your question, which is about the Pan-African future, look, I think that, you know, your president has made it clear what he thinks about us whole countries. You know, that's how we are seen. And I think, in spite of that narrative about what it means to come from Africa, it's very clear that there's lots of interesting cultural exchange happening between African countries. And there is, more importantly, like this global conversation that happens amongst black people, which is fascinating. And because of the contours of racism and the way that white supremacy operates, I think there's so much in common, so much to talk about. So even though it seems like Pan-Africanism is sort of old hat, I think in many ways it's like very, very important, interesting conversation right now. Mm-hmm. Sorry for such a long response.
That's fantastic. Do we have another question from the group? If not, I'll keep asking questions. We do, fantastic. Hello.
I wish I had a question for all of you, because I feel like I've learned so much, but my question's for Catherine, actually. I don't know if you identify as somebody who has had cancer or as a cancer survivor, because there's people pick different things when mm-hmm. they do that. But being of the same community in that sense with you, being of that community that you identify as having had cancer or as a cancer survivor, it's something that can evolve or change and be complex with anything else regarding when it happens, during, afterwards. I was just wondering, when it took writing it down, an aspect of the experience, writing it down, did you more fully identify with that aspect of having had cancer? Was it writing the book? Was it before that you needed to have that identity before you could process it to write the book, or after, and kind of where the book fell in that process?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. I definitely have not been forced. That's not the right word, because I wrote the book. But I chose to identify with cancer, with my cancer, with the cancer community by writing this book. I don't identify as a survivor. I identify as someone who is Ned, which means no evidence of disease. Only because breast cancer in particular is, it's a very nefarious disease to have, and there is no cure. Mm. And even if you've been successfully treated and you are Ned, you have no evidence of disease, it can come back 10, 15, 20 years later, metastasized. So, and they have no idea why. So we lose 40,000 women a year to metastatic cancer, breast cancer, let me be more specific. So by writing the book, I have chosen to identify with folks who've had breast cancer and have become a bit of a spokesperson for those folks. Especially people who have made different choices than the majority, and it's something I'm still kind of figuring out how to embody that identity, because as I mentioned a little while ago, it was not something I was comfortable with, you know, a few years ago. And I think there's also something hard about being identified with a disease, and a deadly, very deadly disease, that it always, you know, it sits right on your shoulder. And no matter who you are, once you've had cancer, it's there. It's a shadow that follows you. It's a part of you. But identifying with it in such a public way and being a representative and a spokesperson for the disease, it takes it to a whole new level. And I'm still finding my seat with it. Yeah, thank you.